The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
To the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles. This episode of Veterans Chronicles will feature a conversation with Sir Martin Gilbert, esteemed historian and official biographer of Winston Churchill. Sir Martin Gilbert passed away last week at age 78. In memoriam, this week's program will feature an episode of an old series, Reminiscences, hosted by Stefan Halper.
Washington, D.C., this is Reminiscences, a weekly conversation with some of the most intriguing personalities of our time.
Welcome to Reminiscences. I'm Stefan Halper. Today we'll be talking with Sir Martin Gilbert. Sir Martin Gilbert is the official biographer of Winston Churchill and an honorary fellow of Merton College, Oxford. Among the foremost historians of this century, he is the author of some 49 books and 12 historical atlases. His subjects include works on Churchill, World Wars I and II, Israel, and the Holocaust. Today, he's two-thirds of the way through a three-volume history of the 20th century and has promised himself to retire when it's finished.
I was born in London. I'm one of the very few people who was both conceived and born during the 10-month reign of King Edward VIII.
Really?
My father was a manufacturing jeweler. He was a self-made man, and he worked away in a small, very dusty little workshop. In fact, I left school at the age of 16.
You did?
And became apprentice to my father. But then I was very unhappy, and my schoolmasters intervened, and they persuaded Dad to let me go back to school and go into the university track.
Mm-hmm. You did find yourself going to Oxford.
Well, first I went into the army. It was the days of national service, compulsory national service. I got into Oxford, and the college which accepted me, Balliol, would have let me go in before the army.
Uh-huh.
But Magdalen also accepted me, and mm-hmm. they said, come in after the army, and they offered a better scholarship.
I see.
So I did my 2 years in the army. I was very lucky to have learned the Russian language. I mm-hmm. went on the Russian course. And so that gave me an extra language, and that affected tremendously my subsequent work and researches.
Mm-hmm.
Who then went to university. I had my 3 years getting a BA. This was in modern history.
Did your father have an interest in history, or?
He did. He had not himself had a higher education. He'd also left school at 16. He read tremendously. He was a very wide reader. In fact, he ruined his eyesight through mm-hmm. reading. And he greatly encouraged me to read. And his interest was history, also historical novels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's curious that recently John Major was trying to persuade me to give up, as he thought, the unlucrative task of writing history and to write historical novels, which he believed, no doubt through his friend Jeremy Archer, were the real money winners.
And your mother, did she share this interest?
She did. I mean, again, I think she suffered, as many women of her generation did, that had she been educated, she could have been a highly educated woman and had a profession mm-hmm. and so on. But she also read. The other thing which my family imbued me with an interest in was travel. Although they couldn't travel very much, my father made a great effort immediately after World War II, in 1946, 47, 48, when I was just sort of 11 or 12, to take me overseas, mm-hmm. to take me, I mean, initially to sort of Ostend and Brussels, places just across the North Sea. But looking back, I realized that was a tremendous influence on me. He wanted me to see what had happened in Europe, something of war-torn Europe.
So you did get a chance then to travel to Germany and Italy? And
I did. Of course, I also, as a schoolboy, I was a boarder. And in a boarding school, the one thing the school can offer in holiday times is trips mm-hmm. with your fellow boarders mm-hmm. to Europe. And our first trip was to essentially the Normandy area to see the beaches, mm-hmm. to see the great fortifications of mm-hmm. Hitler's West Wall. Mm-hmm. So probably from about the age of 12, I was becoming a little seeped in all this period. I was taught to hate Hitler in an extraordinary visit which the school made to Brussels. And in Brussels, in retrospect, it was a sort of trivial thing, but the Germans on leaving had tried to burn down the great Palais de Justice, and it was somehow burnt inside. The building itself was intact, as far as I know. But we were taken to see this by the master, who sort of said, look, you know, this is German barbarism, a burnt-out law court. And this made a tremendous impression on us all.
When you got to Oxford and went to Magdalen, your tutor was A.J.P. Taylor, and one of the great historians. Did you read Russian with him, or?
No, in fact, one thing which he was very good at, he could direct his students in the way he felt they would be most expansive and able to go. And when he knew I had done the Russian, he plunged me into Russian history and encouraged me to do mm-hmm. Russian history. Mm-hmm. He was a very severe teacher. I mean, if he didn't like the essay you read, and the system was every week you read him your answer to the question he'd set you, mm-hmm. if he didn't like it, he could be quite discouraging mm-hmm. and almost demoralizing. By the time he taught me, which was 1959, he was, and one sees it now reading his memoirs and his wife's book about him, he was tired of teaching. He no longer liked it. We got on personally very well, but he was already a bitter man. But he liked nothing better after hours, as it were, to invite one round for a glass of red wine and play music. And he loved play music and talking about history.
Yeah. Winston Churchill has been an enduring theme in your life. What inspired your earliest interests in Churchill?
My earliest interest was when I was at school. The 1950 election took place. Mm-hmm. There was a Labour government. Churchill had been out of power for 5 years. And I've never known the masters, who after all were meant to be the fount of knowledge and wisdom, so disagree among themselves. Some sort of said, you know, Churchill is the greatest man of the century, and others said he's a vicious murderer. Mm-hmm. And for a schoolboy confronted by this battle among the masters, it began to fascinate me, and I started keeping, which I still got, notes of what people said about him. And the other day I was going through some material for my History of the 20th Century, and I was going through my army notes, and I found that I'd done the same in the barracks when the 1955 election came. I'd also taken notes, because the soldiers also disagreed completely. Mm-hmm. Some thought he was, again, the man they must follow, and others thought he was the man they must abuse.
What lies at the base of the accusations of him being a vicious murderer? That's not something we hear much about.
Well, in England, it's tremendously common, and I used to keep, and even sort of before I came to the States 3 days ago, I came across one of these accusations. I nearly cut it out, and I thought, Gilbert, you know, don't, you know, what are you going to do with these cuttings? Actually, one day I do want to write a book called Churchill For and Against, and this mm-hmm. will be one of the themes, mm-hmm. but he was always portrayed by his political enemies as irresponsible. And he was very unlucky that he belonged to the two main political parties at different times. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole period where the Conservatives, who are jolly good at abuse, and the Liberals and then Labour, who are even better at abuse, hurled everything at him. So there was never a period when he was not being attacked by one party or another across the whole spectrum of every party's dislikes.
Right. So he managed to mobilize his enemies with great care.
He did, and one of his favorite things when in public speaking, one of his favorite things, if he was at a sort of a meeting, a rather lively meeting, when people were shouting at things, he would suddenly say, "Is there anybody here I haven't offended? You know, sort of speak up now."
One of the most enduring influences on Churchill was his mother. It was a profound influence. What was their relationship? How did that evolve the way it did?
It was an up-and-down relationship, and there were times when he felt that she was neglecting him when he was a schoolboy. But one
thing... He would write these plaintive letters.
He begged
begging
his parents,
to come home and so on.
Begged his parents to take him more seriously and to be with him more often. But once his father died, when he was still a very young man, he was still only 19, his mother suddenly sort of rallied, if you like. She suddenly took on her responsibilities, though he did once try to bring a legal action against her, W.L.S. Churchill against Lady Randall Churchill, for squandering the father's money. And she defended herself by saying, but wait a minute, I'm only buying jewelry and so on to enhance your political career, to make myself all the more desirable to those who will take you on board, you know, the generals and the politicians. But she then, I think her great service to her son was when he was in the army, and he served mostly in India, with the British Army in India, she sent him the books through which he, who had not been to university, educated himself. She provided him with this great library. I got into terrible trouble when I lectured at the Citadel in South Carolina, in the presence of the then ruler of the Citadel, it's a school,
right.
General Mark Clark, and I was describing, I said, picture Churchill in his tent with 50 or 60 books stacked up, and there was a gasp among these students, and it turned out afterwards the general, Mark Clark, had said, never more than 5 books in your study.
Can you put your finger on what it was that prevented them from taking him more seriously, spending more time with him when they were together, that is, before his father died? Was there something in the relationship between the parents that excluded Churchill?
There were several things. First of all, his father did become very ill. It's not exactly clear what his father was suffering from, but his father's personality disintegrated and he became very vicious, almost fantasized about his son's stupidity. And it's clear from his son's report that he often came top of the class in the principal subjects, particularly history, English, geography. As for the mother, I think she simply led an independent life. She did have her friends, her lovers, her other world. And a son at boarding school is someone who is very easy to be dismissed. And in the summer holidays, you send him away with his aunts, his uncles, or, you know, kindly people of bad estates.
More conversation with Sir Martin Gilbert after this short break. Thanks for tuning in to Reminiscences.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
This is Reminiscences. I'm Stefan Halper. My guest today is Sir Martin Gilbert. Sir Martin, we're talking about Winston Churchill, and one of the questions that I'm curious about is the ways in which his mother was very helpful to his career. Was it more Were there more things than simply sending books to him when he was in the military in India?
There were more things. First of all, she sent him letters about his character. When she felt that he was behaving badly, perhaps a little arrogantly, perhaps too aristocratically, she said so. But most of all, she had her own friends and indeed lovers who were well-placed both in the political and military hierarchy. And when he wanted to go to serve on a particular army campaign, she went to the general in charge and said, take Winston on it. And when she wanted him to go into...
rather direct.
When she wanted him to go into politics, she found the political leaders who could push him forward. I mean, no young man has ever entered politics with such senior political figures as his mother's intimates.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely fascinating. I mean, that's very interesting. It puts one in mind somewhat of the Kennedys, but in a different time, different place, all the same. Turning to Churchill's experience in South Africa, which was very dramatic, let me just ask you, why was it so important to his development?
When he went out to South Africa, he was floundering. He'd been a soldier for 4 or 5 years. He'd enjoyed some of it, but he hadn't liked being shot at, and he realized this was not his career. He didn't want to end up being a colonel or even a general. At the same time, he'd done a lot of journalism very successfully, earned a lot of money, had his reports, particularly from Cuba. He went during one of the Spanish-Cuban exchanges. He was a good reporter, and he indeed went out to South Africa to report. But even that didn't satisfy him. He had a brilliant idea to go out and take a moving film of the War of South Africa. He bought a camera and everything and a man to operate it. And he was simply beaten at the post because the American Biograph Company decided to go. And the idea of having two film companies filming this enormous war was too much. So he was looking for a way forward, a career. And when he was captured by the Boers and managed to escape, it was a dramatic escape, and he managed to get down to the Indian Ocean and took a boat to Durban, which was held by the British, and suddenly discovered that he was being welcomed as a hero. And the key was that there had been several very bad British defeats in the war, and the British public were depressed. You know, after all, who were the Boers? And they were defeating the British Empire. And suddenly this escape, this cocky fellow, had somehow cocked a snook at them. And when he came back to England, he was staggered to find crowds in the street cheering him. It really was a story of inspiring a nation at a time when a war was going badly. Uh-huh. And he grasped the nettle. He had already tried to get into politics and been beaten. He stood again. He got in. And he found himself the sort of hero of the hour.
Uh-huh. Was part of his success the filing of dramatic stories? He did manage to get some good stories back to London. And as you say, he was paid a great deal of money. How did he manage that?
Well, his stories were good. He was paid a lot of money. He went out to every war as a correspondent, although he often joined up then to see some of the action. And he wrote very well. He had a gift of writing.
I mean, I saw one figure where he was paid, I think it was 1,000-something pounds back in this period, which would have been almost 40,000 pounds in today's terms.
By the age of 21, he was the highest paid journalist in England, and England was a country which had some very senior and distinguished journalists.
I mean,
that
is a huge achievement in itself.
Yeah. Oh, no, he could have made his living as a writer, and indeed did make a substantial fortune as a writer in every decade of his life, although he had many responsibilities and often lost the money he'd made or had to give it out to his growing family and sometimes his profligate son.
Were the tales of his heroism in South Africa entirely legitimate? Were they real, or were they partly manufactured in the creation of a myth?
I think they were very real. In fact, he was quite modest in his books. The book he wrote about South Africa, this book, My Early Life, which was a potboiler written when he needed money in 1930, is far too modest about his achievements. And in the archives, it's clear, for example, in the battle you mentioned when he clambered up this hill to see where the enemy was, that he had done, you know, he had been a very brave act. And he was even recommended for the Victoria Cross, for the highest award of bravery for it. And, you know, I think there were many occasions when he also did things which marked him out as rather different to even an ordinary brave soldier. When a friend of his was very badly wounded, he had the surgeon cut away a piece of his own flesh from his chest to graft on the wound of his friend. Now,
really?
He never told anybody that, and he was, you know... that was an extraordinary thing. And, you know, in a way you could have made political capital out of it, but it's just something he did.
So, Martin, we're going to have to take a short break. The program is Reminiscences from Radio America. We'll be right back.
This is the Radio America Network.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
We remember 24 hours a day.
We study the news and history.
We assemble information. We speak out.
And we listen to you.
And we don't forget that every pleasant minute of this freedom we owe to those who defend it.
So, here's to life.
The freedom of conscience.
And liberty.
Thank God Almighty!
And the pursuit of happiness.
Thanks for tuning in to Reminiscences, Walk Through History from Radio America. This week we're talking with Sir Martin Gilbert. Sir Martin, the next time that Winston Churchill found himself in conflict was World War I. And of course it was a defining event in the century. Many things have flowed from it. What did Churchill take from it?
First of all, he suffered a tremendous political setback. A scheme which he devised to defeat Turkey at the Dardanelles rather quickly, knock Turkey out of the war, and perhaps end the war in 1915 or 16, failed. And until then, I think one could say none of his enterprises had failed. He'd advanced. He was 40 years old, no age at all. He was the pinnacle of political power.
And this was a high-profile disaster.
It was a high-profile disaster, and everybody turned against him. And at the same time as the stigma of failure, which affected his political career right through to 1939, was his inner conviction that he had been right. And I think this is the key to his whole development. He was convinced that his scheme, had it been properly carried out in the field, would have succeeded. And the more people accused him of being responsible for loss of life, the more he felt he had been misunderstood. And this created a grievance, but a confidence in his own judgment, which he didn't think was belied in any way. Indeed, the reverse. He felt it was confirmed by the ignorant hostility thrown at him.
Most people's career would have been ended by this disaster of this magnitude.
Most people's career would indeed have been ended, and it was assumed his was ended, and he went off to the Western Front and fought in the trenches, which again was an extraordinary thing for a man of 40 who could certainly have, he was still a member of Parliament, he could certainly have, you know, remained in politics. And when he was nearly killed by a German shell, he wrote an incredible letter to his wife where he said, if I'd been killed, and I quote it exactly, it would have been a loss for the war-making power of Britain, which no one will ever know or measure or mourn. Now, for a politician who's been chucked out to see himself possessing this war-making power of Britain is extraordinary.
Modesty was not one of his long suits.
No, but you see, he would not have seen it in those terms. I think in those terms he wouldn't have lasted very long. He would have become a crank. Oh. But he could always confront his critics with this extraordinary inner conviction that he had been right.
Let me take another minute on this. You've looked at Gallipoli, which is what we're talking about, this disaster. Would Churchill's plan have worked?
You know, even if the Admiral had had a second go, which he originally wanted to do after the first naval attack had been stopped with very small loss of life, if the Admiral had had a second go, it might have worked. But what happened was the government in London, against Churchill's wishes, said, look, let's stop trying to do it by ships alone. Let's take an army there. And it was taken out of Churchill's hands, put into the hand of this great warlord, Lord Kitchener, the man who'd said, you know, England needs you. And Kitchener then really made a total mess of it. And that's the basis of Churchill's conviction that he had been right, was to see how, once the army was brought in, all the elements of a military campaign were mismanaged.
Right. Let me go on. In September of 39 and until May of 1940, Winston Churchill was First Lord of the Admiralty. major position, obviously, considering the gathering clouds of World War II and the huge buildup of German military, particularly naval strength. Tell us a little bit about that time.
Well, he'd spent 10 years in the wilderness. He'd been out of office, and in retrospect, he felt this was a very good thing because it meant he could not be tarred with the brush of whatever the negative elements of appeasement were, inasmuch as Britain had tried to do a deal with Hitler, inasmuch as Britain had betrayed Czechoslovakia. He had been excluded by his party. It was his party which did it, but they'd kept him out of power. So when he went to the Admiralty on the first day of war, it was really, as I must say, a Mr. Clean, and the public appreciated that. But more than being a Mr. Clean, he had a conviction that Nazism had to be fought.
Listening to Reminiscences. I'm Stefan Helfer. We've been talking with Sir Martin Gilbert. Sir Martin, let me bring you to the so-called wilderness years. This was a time when Churchill was out of office. He was all but, perhaps by some people, forgotten. What did he do during this time? Why were they important to him?
Wilderness years were important because initially he was depressed and he thought it was the end of his political career. He was in his 50s. The Conservative Party to which he belonged had been beaten. The refashioned Conservative Party didn't want him. And the policies it pursued, both the move towards Indian independence, which he felt was too rapid, and the appeasement of Nazi Germany, which he felt was morally wrong, kept him outside. At first, he thought of retiring. He came over to the New World. He traveled around. He went to look at a ranch in Canada. He thought he might buy that, become a farmer, because he loved his farms and he loved his the countryside. But then he went back, and he plunged into politics. And he always had a few devoted parliamentarians who supported him, and he always filled up the House of Commons. Even when he said things the majority did not like to hear, he said it almost in a Cassandra way when he spoke against Munich in the famous Munich debate and said that we have suffered a defeat without a war and that we would eventually have war and also shame. The House, which did not agree with him, the majority, listened, and many members told me when he'd finished speaking, the palms of their hands were sweating. They really understood that somehow this man was right. He maintained himself in the wilderness years by writing. He wrote books, he wrote articles. Mm-hmm. Every 2 weeks he published an article. He even started broadcasting to the United States. Mm-hmm. He was mm-hmm. tremendously active, and I often wonder what went through his mind. And one sees him painting, one sees him playing polo, he's been enjoying himself, enjoying meals. But I have a funny idea, and those that knew him very well have told me this again and again, that he never ceased thinking of his country. He had this terrible vision that if Britain didn't get its act together, it would be defeated, it would go down the tubes, it would be over. And he often used to cite the very powerful and terrible lines of Byron: "A thousand years scarce serve to form a state, an hour can lay it in the dust." And he was petrified that by Neville Chamberlain's negligence of Britain's defences, particularly in the air, because he understood about air power, he was terrified that Britain would simply not be in a position to resist the Germans, would have to surrender to them.
You mention Neville Chamberlain, of course, and the enmity between the two of them is legendary.
We know from the archives, and I've put this in my book, so it's very sad, that Chamberlain made every effort behind the scenes to spread unpleasant rumors about Churchill, untrue stories, excluded him very unfairly from any position of authority, and let it be known that he simply wouldn't have him in. And on one occasion spoke of how Churchill's judgment was defective. And Churchill was deeply hurt by this. He felt this was absolutely monstrous. You know, there was Churchill, who happened by then to be the most senior conservative in the party, the most senior member of the Conservative Party in Parliament, to be told that his judgment was defective was insulting. And so he was very distressed by Chamberlain's behaviour and, you know, was outspoken against Chamberlain's policy right. of appeasement. A curious thing happened after Churchill entered the government, which the public were demanding.
This is after September of 39.
After September 39, he had a supper with Chamberlain, and Chamberlain suddenly started telling the story of his struggles as a young man in the Bahamas to make an... he was working there on an agricultural estate, and Chamberlain started describing his terrible struggles against nature and, you know, against... And Churchill reflected and said, what a pity Hitler didn't know that this man had in him such a toughness.
You know, you mentioned Churchill's uncanny ability to identify talent, even when it was largely obscured. And it brings to my mind the faith he placed in Sir Hugh Dowding, the father, really, of Britain's fighter squadrons, the Hurricanes and Spitfires that confronted Hermann Göring's air Luftwaffe in the air war. How did he manage to identify Dowding? Dowding was a difficult man, lacking in grace, abrasive. Just as an example of how Churchill ferreted these characters out, how did that all work?
It's a very good example, because Dowding was a dour and uncommunicative and was hated by the air staff, who indeed constantly tried to remove him and downgrade him. And when they came to write the history of the Battle of Britain, to Churchill's fury, didn't even mention the name of the man who had commanded the Spitfires and the few. And Churchill was good at spotting people. Funnily enough, it's often said of him that he wasn't, that he allowed himself to be surrounded by sort of yes-men and unsatisfactory characters. But I've looked at some of his closest working colleagues, and I see that what he grasped was the essence of a person's abilities. And then any other eccentricities didn't matter to him.
Yeah.
You know, if a fellow wore red socks like the present British ambassador to the United States, it didn't matter to him. He understood the essence of a man's qualities and was very loyal to those who came to him and said, Prime Minister, this is not right or that is not right, when he realized they were telling the truth.
Having said that now, Churchill had a peculiar genius, really, in this regard, and it came out in his administration of his wartime cabinet, which was a difficult crowd, to say the least, aside from the fact they came from different political parties. Many of them had a great deal of personal enmity towards each other, and Britain was on the cusp of being defeated. How did he manage it?
I think he managed it because they all recognized that he would not give in. And there's a very interesting letter which he wrote to Roosevelt at the height of the Blitz, when things were going badly for Britain, when he said to Roosevelt, look, you have to understand, if things go very badly, a government may be called into power to make peace with Hitler, and one would have to appreciate that, but I, Churchill, will not be a member of it. And that, of course, was true. He would not have been a member of it. But I think the key to that letter to Roosevelt is he reflected the reason why his ministers would follow him through thick and thin, despite many disagreements over policy and programs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They understood he would not give in, that there wasn't going to be some little secret negotiation or trimming or half-hearted war-making. Mm-hmm. And I think when a country is on its own, as we were after the fall of France, Belgium, Holland, Norway and Denmark and Poland, when we were all on our own and Russia and Hitler were allied and America was still waiting the wings, this was the key element in his character and in what made him the war leader. Not, I think, necessarily the words of his speeches or even the nitty-gritty of his policy, but the realization this man is not going to throw in the sponge.
You mentioned a moment ago his appreciation of people's talent and his ability to look beyond their eccentricities. Churchill himself had some rather bizarre working habits. He worked till all hours of the morning. He was a peculiar man in terms of his own personal, the way he presented himself.
Well, I don't think he was as peculiar as all that. He had some odd habits, but they have been sort of misrepresented. And as for the late night working, what one has to realize is Britain had a very precious war-making tool, and that was we were reading on an hourly basis the most secret German communications between headquarters and commanders-in-chief. And it was essential for the whole inner cabinet, or for those people privy to this secret, Churchill and the chiefs of staff, essentially, to get together after dinner to see what the latest top-secret development of tactical as well as strategic. You know, what were the Germans planning at 4 in the morning? If you knew that at 1 a.m., you had to study it and respond to it. Yeah. And, of course, the public could never be told that. And, ironically, because the secret was so preserved, not one of those who wrote their memoirs who knew of it referred to it. Not one. And, of course, it was never leaked to the Germans, thank God.
Remarkable. Churchill and Roosevelt seemed to get on very well. Could you tell us a bit about their relationship?
Churchill understood, I would say, from about 1906, that there could be no prevailing of the democratic forces in times of dire emergency without the United States being a partner and a fully committed partner. And it was he, during the First World War, who insisted in the inner cabinets that you cannot go on attacking the Germans with these frontal assaults. He opposed the Passchendaele offensive. You have to wait until the Americans come in force. Only America can really be the make weight in these battles. And he understood throughout the 30s the same was true. He knew America. He'd visited America several times. He knew that isolationism was real. But he also knew that there was an element, as he would have called it, in the American democracy, which would in the end stand firm. And he saw Roosevelt, I think rightly, surely, as the not only the representative of that, but as the person who would take risks, and the risk Roosevelt took in 1940 against perhaps the general instinct of the American people to commit America in so many ways to Britain. Without them, we could not have won the war.
We'll be back in a minute to continue our conversation with Sir Martin Gilbert. Stay with us.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.
Welcome back. I'm Stefan Helfer. We've been talking with Sir Martin Gilbert. Sir Martin, let me take you from his relationship with Roosevelt to his relationship with Stalin. Obviously, there was no love lost between them. Did he and Roosevelt have different views of Stalin and the prospective role of the Soviet Union as the war drew to a close?
I've always thought the differences between Churchill and Roosevelt with regard to Stalin and the Soviet Union have been exaggerated. Both of them had to face the fact that Stalin had nearly 200 divisions of fighting troops in the east, that his armies were advancing very rapidly. They were conquering these countries. Churchill tried to set up a Yalta conference 6 months before Yalta. He wanted to hold it in Jerusalem, incidentally, before the Red Army was in place in all the capitals of Eastern Europe, but Stalin wouldn't come. And by the time they got to Yalta, all these great capitals, Budapest, Bucharest, Warsaw, and so on, were basically under the Soviet thumb. And therefore, both Churchill and Roosevelt were dependent. They may have had different ways of going about the negotiation, but both of them were dependent upon Stalin's signature being genuine. Now, he was the ally. They depended upon him as much as he on them for the defeat of Germany. Yeah. They couldn't say, we don't believe you. And when he not only signed all these declarations, the Declaration on Captive Peoples, free elections in Poland, offered to accelerate the Polish elections, if that was what was required. I mean, generally was the phrase used was affable. His friends say affable. Yes, let's sign it. You know, we'll have democracy in Europe after the war. There was nothing they could do but append their signatures. They couldn't be the ones who said no.
But let me ask you, was Roosevelt said to have been ill at Yalta, and Churchill is said to have had to sort of lead the conversation to some degree. Was that the case?
Well, Roosevelt was very ill, but the American team was not ill, and the American position was not ill.
Right.
Of course, there had always been these differences. Roosevelt's suspicion of the British imperial element, and of course, Churchill had tried to get out of various elements of the Atlantic Charter.
Right.
He tried to as it were, maintain a British imperial structure, which was not to the Americans' liking. But with regard to Eastern Europe, both of them were up against the same phenomenon.
Right.
And very rapidly, of course, after Roosevelt's death, Churchill and Truman found they were totally on the same wavelength.
Well, last question on Mr. Churchill. What was his attitude toward the rebuilding of Europe after the war, in particular towards Germany and Italy?
When the United Europe movement began, Churchill went to Strasbourg, and it was a small movement at that time, and he said, "Where are the Germans?" And everybody looked around. Of course, there weren't Germans there at that time. He said, "We'll bring them in. Without the Germans, we'll get nowhere." And one of the interesting things about Churchill's vision of a united Europe, and he really believed in it, not necessarily to the exclusion of Britain and the Commonwealth, or indeed the Anglo-American axis, but he believed Europe should be united. But central to his vision was that even the Soviet Union could come into the united Europe if the Soviet element were to go, and he had a strange confidence, which he expressed at MIT in 1949, that the communist nightmare would disintegrate one day.
Would he be accepting of the arrangements being made today, in which NATO is being expanded and the Russians are wanting to play a larger role in continental Europe?
One can never say what a person would have accepted or at what time, but he wanted Russia to have its role, and the whole key of his Fulton speech, which is often said to have started the Cold War, the whole key of the Fulton speech is we must all be together, we must rebuild what he called the sinews of peace, and perhaps one day Russia will join us. So there was always that optimistic element,
always the hope,
or the universalist element in it.
If I can, we only have a couple of minutes left, I'd like to turn to your interest in the Holocaust and ask you why it is that with such a complete historical record, the Holocaust phenomena continues to be alive and well. We saw millions killed in the Soviet Union, Cambodia, more recently in Rwanda. And it seems as if, in a way, this is a very dark part of the human condition. Can you speculate as to why the international community is so slow to act?
I suppose the problem is there isn't really an international community. I mean, the last time we had... the last time we had real United Nations action was the Korean War, and that ended in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, it's always been up to, say, America or America-Britain working together, or at the time of the Gulf War, a coalition cobbled together, I mean, brilliantly, but very transitory in a way. Yeah. And I think that the other thing is we feel the Holocaust could have been prevented, and yet nothing can be prevented when it starts. The question is, how long does it take to cobble together, to get together some form of international action? And even if it takes 2 weeks, there will be many dead, but 2 months, 6 months, and then you've had your Holocaust, you've had your genocide.
Sir Martin, I'm terribly sorry that we have run out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining me today. I'm Stefan Helper. Please join us again for another edition of Reminiscences.